Ball is live. We are so excited to be here and with you on recapping and talking about this most excellent episode. Every time a new episode comes out, I'm always like, oh my gosh, this episode is amazing. And this time I get to talk about it with friends. And I'm super excited to introduce my panel of fellow podcasters and joyful people here to chat about season 2, episode 10 of Ted Lasso. With me today, I'm never going to give you up, Shannon Sutterth.
Hello, and I appreciate everyone's integrity on this podcast.
And never going to let you down, Chip Sutterth.
I need to warn everybody, I'm only going to become more wonderful.
And never gonna run around and desert you, Keir Hansen.
I've been told to come in and ask you all to lower your voices.
We'll do our best to keep our levels even. But until we hit that point of just sheer excitement where we discover who Rebecca is sleeping with, let's instead kind of go through our overall impressions of this episode. I'd love to know what you all thought.
I want to know how they fit an entire movie into that episode, because there was so much.
Yes.
So much.
I like that each of these episodes seem to be getting thicker with plot, and partially because they are longer. But oh my goodness, it's so that this episode was so full that I watched it for a third time that I finished 10 minutes before we started recording, because it's just so much.
How did this episode manage, after so many years, to make Rick Rowling both still amusing and emotionally relevant? Because, my God.
Chip, I don't know of your experience with elementary school or middle school kids, but Rick Rowling has been hot for decades.
That's my point. My point. It should be a cliche by now. It should be painful, and yet.
It comes all the way around the dial. And then comes back on the other side to be wonderful again.
I appreciate it.
This is something where I think some of the risks that they're taking at this stage in the season, and specifically within this episode, as far as laying out things in such a raw manner, this is the most opportune time to do it. This is something where I don't think they would have been able to take these sort of liberties or take these chances, maybe even as early as 2 episodes prior. We had to be at this point and be this invested in characters that we may not have even necessarily wanted to be that invested in at this point, but we can't help ourselves. The ensemble's that good.
100%. Every time one of a character that you maybe like didn't necessarily have a deep thought about, for example, Deborah, Rebecca's mom, she was like, oh, it's that kind of a character in previous episodes, but in this one, you learn so much more about her that you're like, oh my gosh, why did I second guess who she was as a character in the show? Yeah.
I am fully invested at this point in the characters. I am seeing new layers in every one of them that I come around to, with the possible exception of Rupert, who is the platonic ideal of a toad. But it makes me feel like it makes me second guess myself about this show a little bit, in the fact that, you know, can this show be so good? How intelligent or interesting are my thoughts about this show if I think that everything is wonderful? You know, I struggle a little bit in this episode to find, okay, what would I tweak about this thing? What didn't entirely work for me? But while there are some things that we'll get to that didn't sit 100% with me right at the beginning, I'm just amazed at how complex and complicated this show keeps becoming.
Mm, dense. There are, you can say what you want about your primary, secondary, maybe even tertiary storylines, but we're at the point now where if you can process it all fast enough, you want to take in everything. You're noticing little bits in the background characters. You know, you want to say what horrible, you want to find out what horrible thing Jan is going to say next because he just doesn't get social cues or any of those things. Everybody is precious and everybody is necessary at this point.
Yeah. Like I said, we only saw Deborah one episode previously, and we all had our impression of her. And yet, within the span of this episode, the writers, you know, with just an economy of dialogue, yes, over such a gut-wrenching scene, as Rebecca confesses that she caught her dad cheating, and Deborah's like, well, yeah, I knew. And just the layers there that, you know, it was important to her for all her reasons to keep the marriage, to stay in the marriage and keep going. And yeah, just, you know, by the end to come around and see her and Rebecca about to step into this new and hopefully wonderful stage in their relationship.
There's a level of care for these minor characters that even if they hadn't had this be a big plot line, and like taking the care of each character matters. Mm-hmm. And there's a reverence that they do, not in a, oh my gosh, I'm going to put this character on a pedestal, but an awareness and I keep saying care, but I can't think of a better word. I'm not a writer. A care for each of these characters and what they bring to the story, and not just a, oh, here's a throwaway. This is who this person is.
It's Ted's outlook. Everybody matters.
Yes.
So all the way back to season one, and, you know, Ted's remembers Nate's name immediately. Ted goes to the restaurant that the driver's dad runs. You know, he makes an effort to try his best to get to know the people around him, and we'll get to more about why later.
Yeah.
You know, the writing team has the same approach, that every character that appears on screen deserves a little depth, deserves nuances, and it's wonderful.
I think that's a testament to the team aspect of the writing and editing for this show writ large, because this is something where, in order to be mindful or respectful or cognizant of all of these moving pieces that they have set in motion and gotten us as viewers emotionally invested in, I think it benefits them to have a series of writers, or, you know, head writers and people there to sort of back up and guide along the way and say, you know what, we haven't really checked in with where Nate was headed with his ego issues, or we haven't, you know, maybe we have to be aware of what's going on between these two or three characters, because they had a bit of a falling out previously that's going to have some bearing on their interaction in this scene. And I think if you might get slightly myopic if there's just a single writer trying to drive this many characters forward respectfully.
Not everyone can be a J. Michael Straczynski.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I like how they are very poignant and purposeful with each of those. So, I mean, like you were talking about, Nate's story, Nate's bit in this episode is a great example where he's had this progressive, you know, whatever you want to call it, over the past season. And in this episode, he's on screen, what, three times?
Mm-hmm. And around each, that.
Each moment, you know, that I want to be a tiger so I could eat people. Oh, yeah, this is the suit that Ted bought me, but not everybody, you know, my mom buys my clothes. And then the moment at the end with Rupert, it's very purposeful, because too much would not leave anything to the imagination, like exposition, and you are still aware of the story, even though that's not the main purpose of this episode. No one's forgotten. Mm-hmm. Everything has purpose.
I'm still going, you talk about leaving things to the imagination. I am going to lose continued sleep trying to figure out what it was that Rupert said to Nate at the end.
I know. Don't worry, we'll find out. I'm sure it's been plotted for the past year.
I have much speculation, but we will see.
Well, you know what? Screw format. Let's talk about it now. We're already in it. Let's talk about that speculation.
I mean, my prediction is that Rupert had to sell off the last bit of his ownership in the team because he's about to buy another team and he's about to try and poach Nate. So,
yeah. I know that's a super popular theory, and I love well, I love hate that that idea, mm-hmm. specifically because I know how much Rupert wants somebody that he can control.
Well, yeah.
And this is a great example, but it makes me wonder. Well, and so a note that I took in my third watch is when Nate's doing that tiger mm-hmm. conversation, the beat in the middle of his sentence is Beard looking at him.
Right.
And we know that Beard has kind of been a Jiminy Cricket and an awareness of everything that's going on with mm-hmm. everyone. He knows what's going on in Nate's brain.
Or he's realized that his previous talk maybe did not accomplish everything he wanted it to.
Exactly, exactly. And so I wonder how much of the future is going to be Coach Beard coming in and, mm-hmm. you know, putting a little bit more pressure, shall we say, on mm-hmm. Nate to be less of a redacted word on this family-friendly show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Ted noticed it too. So, mm-hmm. you know, his eyebrows shifted a little bit as Nate was saying that.
And of course, Rebecca. So
yeah, so I think that... I think that it's been clear all along, even if you pay attention in season one, that Nate has some anger, self-esteem issues, and things like that that are really finally coming to a head. And I think that I think that something possibly Rupert purchasing another team and poaching Nate. Something like that is definitely going to happen at the end of the season. I think that's the timing is right. We've only got mm-hmm. two episodes left to go to. We need a cliffhanger for season three. And, you know, again, every character is complex and, complicated except for possibly Rupert. And that includes Nate. You know, he could go either way. The episode opens when Ted is getting ready before his panic attack. You know, there's a thank you note on mm-hmm. his dresser from Nate. And then the episode makes a point of, you know, isn't that the suit that Ted got for you? And Jan Hus makes the cutting remark about people buying you clothes being emasculating. And if there's anything that we've seen that Nate cannot handle this mm-hmm. year, it's being mocked or belittled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think it's all building to something like that. And I keep coming back to one moment of vulnerability that Ted shared with the entire coaching staff plus Leslie. When Ted shared the fact of his panic attack with them all. If there's anybody who has the potential for using that mm-hmm. in a harmful mm-hmm. way at this point, it's Nate. And I just feel like something like that is coming in the next couple of episodes. And that whisper from Rupert to Nate is just the signal that stuff's going to come down.
Yeah, there has, like you said, this is building up. It's been all season. It's only getting worse. That sort of perfect storm that's coming mm-hmm. is going to be impactful and it's going to be purposeful. And I can't wait to see what it is, even though it's really stressing me out worrying about it.
Yeah.
It's going to be, even if it dances anywhere close to that end result, it's going to be one of those aching pains because of watching the deterioration of a character who was just starting to emerge from the chrysalis, so to speak.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
While you're being handed something like on the other end of the teeter-totter, you've got the rather began despicable Jamie Tartt, mm-hmm. who has now been laid out bare and raw, yeah. and is showing real positive growth. So watching these two characters on either end of that tip is fascinating, but is
and
also
not expected.
No, really not. I'm trying to think about the way that they ended season one was with they started dropping breadcrumbs. You saw something was coming. You knew you could hear the train whistle somewhere behind you, sort of a thing. But what actually ended up striking us was rather left turn. And I'm wondering if they are doing a sort of a pump fake here as well. I honestly don't know.
Well, and speaking of pump fakes, I hope that a pump fake is Keeley's relationship with Roy versus Jamie. And I know that the very obvious layout of this is, oh, poor Keeley's looking at, you know, how Roy is versus how Jamie came in and just was so raw and vulnerable, and having this like love triangle happening, possibly, maybe, what's going to happen? And I really hope that they don't go the obvious way. There's so much potential here.
Well, I mean, on the other hand, one of the things that's been so amazing about the show is its ability to be unexpected.
Yes.
And to do things in ways that you did not see coming. So, you know, I'm kind of like at a point where I trust these writers at this point. I trust them. They have not done anything to betray that trust, that whatever happens, it will be complicated. It might get messy. It's probably going to hurt. But in the end, I'm going to feel like they caught the viewers. So at the moment, yes. I'm still good.
Yeah. I'm too nervous.
And this show has also been really good about showing an entire spectrum of human relationships and how people relate to each other romantically, platonically, in between, whatever. I mean, Danny Rojas is non-monogamous. Ted and Rebecca have this just really strong platonic bond. What's going on with Keeley now that Jamie has professed his love for her? You know, who knows how all of this is going to work out? It could be a traditional love triangle plot. It could be something completely different. Who knows? So I've got additional faith that whatever's in store from the writers, that it will be interesting and it'll be good television. I think, and a friend of mine once mentioned this after watching this episode, you know, I hope that viewers are going to be kind and respectful towards the Keeley character, regardless of what happens, because mm-hmm. people are complicated. And mm-hmm. And if there's anything that, you know, back in season one, before she connected with Roy, you know, there was no evidence that Keeley was looking for long-term mature love. You know, there was a process mm-hmm, yeah. that she went through throughout all of this. And she wouldn't have been looking for a statement from Jamie like this one at that time. She has just witnessed, she's witnessed Jamie becoming more mature. And that is something that attracted her to Roy once she recognized that that was what she wanted. Is she seeing Jamie make this development, and is she just sort of, I wish I'd wanted this, and I wish you had been there at the same time? You know, is she looking at all this wistfully? I don't think she's genuinely torn between Roy and Jamie, but who knows where this will go?
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that it's interesting to watch Jamie becoming more worthy of that attention,
yes.
more worthy of respect, regardless of what happens.
And not make Roy the bad guy, like shifting into someone who's not worthy, which is right. such a common trope. Roy, his apology and vulnerability, like, just shows his maturity and mm-hmm. how much he does care about Keeley, because he's like recognizing, oh man, I probably shouldn't have tried to make the jokes that I did. Although, avenged me, Keeley, avenged me was
that
hilarious.
Was fun. That was hilarious. Yes,
and
I didn't
sorry.
Know about the kid.
Yeah. And he made an Obi-Wan reference.
Yes.
So all is good with the world. And that's all I needed.
Yeah. It's I can't wait to see what they do with it. I know. Oh gosh, I can't believe I said that unironically on a non-Apple based conversation. But I am excited, but also very, very nervous. Just because I love Keeley and Roy so very much.
Right off the cuff, like if you were to make a gut reaction, do you feel, just don't think about it too hard, whether or not Keeley is going to tell Roy what Jamie admitted?
I think she would. I think it's going to be in a spot. I don't think it's going to be right away. Like, I don't think that she'd go home and say, oh, by the way, while I was being pissed at you, Jamie came up and told me, you know, admitted his love to me. But I think in the future, possibly, because she knows how to handle Roy. That sounds bad.
She's one of the few people that can.
Yeah, and so I think she would know when it would be a time to mention it and have that be part of a adult conversation about the relationship and kind of see how he fits, but also how she feels a little bit more, using him as a sounding board to see what this means for her and her life.
I think that she would tell Roy if it actually stood to impact her relationship with him. And the fact that she just sort of had this emotional reaction to Jamie saying that means that she probably will, but mm-hmm. but she's not just going to say it randomly. She's not going to just you know, because she knows that Jamie saying that would make Roy uncomfortable, mm-hmm. potentially affect Roy and Jamie's relationship at work. So mm-hmm. there's got to be a reason for it.
Yeah.
Especially in light of the fact that they have now, while it is a very small patch of common ground, Roy and Jamie have had a moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Which she doesn't know about unless Roy told her about it, which is entirely
possible.
Yeah, we don't
know if she's aware of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I
don't know if he would tell her. Because I don't know if it would be a thing that he would, not in a, oh my gosh, it's a secretive type of thing, but mm-hmm. I don't know if it would have come up in a conversation.
I mean, I think we can probably assume that Keeley is aware of Jamie's dad. They were together for a while. He almost certainly vented about it to her. So whether or not Roy shared what happened in the locker room, I don't know. I don't know if that had come up or not, but yeah, there's just so many possibilities with this entire, what they have set up here. It can go in so many directions.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be super curious to see what happens. And I just hope that, I really hope, again, like Chip said, I hope that viewers respect whatever Keeley decides to do, because the entire, not the entire arc, but so much of Keeley's movement in season one and into season two has been the fact that she has been able to own her life mm-hmm. and accomplish what she wants to accomplish.
Yes.
Separate from any romantic relationships.
Yes. So, which is so amazing. I just love how they treat the female characters in this show.
Uh-huh.
It's just, and it's so sad that it's so poignant with how well they treat them all.
That's a whole other layer that this episode brings us, with all of the female characters together and talking, and nobody, you know, I mean, yes, we've got Rebecca and her mother's issue, but aside from that, you know, they are all enjoying each other's romantic potential. I mean, even Nora.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Everyone in my Ted Lasso Discord was just like waiting to see just how upset Nora was going to be that Rebecca poached her crush. And what does she do? Boss ass bitch.
Yeah.
I mean, I almost fist pumped the air for that one.
I got chills, because I was like, especially when she was in the room with that reveal and not like mm-hmm. hearing it, but hearing the very, very visceral reaction of how did you know? How did you figure it out or whatever? Mm-hmm. And seeing her so happy for Aunt Rebecca mm-hmm. just was like amazing. And I just love the joy that they can all have in each other's relationships.
Right. Right. Yeah, they're supportive of, you know, whatever Rebecca wants to do with Sam. They're supportive of, you know, whatever this on-again, off-again thing might be between Sassy and Ted. You know, they're supportive of, you know, Keeley and Roy. They just really don't see that often enough in entertainment, in media, where women are supporting one another without jealousy, you know, approaching things with intelligence and care, again, to go back.
Yeah, I love it all. And the joy in how they can be serious and supportive when Keeley comes up and tells Rebecca, "I hate that baby," and like just all of those, you know, clearly humorous jokes. And then, "I'm never going to leave your side," and a beat. And then, "Oh my gosh, I see Sassy. I'm going to go run screaming through the church." Like that level of trust in the characters is great, because you know that Rebecca's like, "Oh, Keeley and Sassy," not, "Oh my gosh, she just lied to me. She said she was going to stay by my side and then left me." Like, that's not there. And I love that.
Right. And even going back to the fact that, you know, Keeley and Sassy do have this great relationship. Because, you know, in season one, it would have been the logical thing for Keeley to be jealous of Sassy. Keeley has this
and
great
Sassy
new friendship.
Be jealous of Keeley.
Yeah, it's because they have these great friendships with Rebecca. And instead of competing over who's Rebecca's best friend now, they get along just as well. And now we've got a triangle of, you know, close friends.
Yeah. Supportive triangle. Oh, goodness. Well, and speaking of a supportive, well, I guess two dots.
A supportive line.
Quite a triangle. A supportive line. Oh, look at that. Look at that logic. Rebecca and Sam started out this episode in such a sweet moment. And I love that it takes a little bit before you realize how long that they've been together. Because it could have been the next day.
Right.
But it wasn't. And the casualness and the care that they had for each other and just the joyful relationship just made me so happy. And I love how it bookends the joyful relationship between Rebecca and her mom in bed at the end of the episode. Two very different relationships that started the episode very different, clearly. And just so sweet, and the care that they have to show that it's not just, you know, this passionate whatever, but that all of the buildup they had over the conversations on the app clearly translated to in person.
Yeah. Yeah, I see so many people wringing their hands over the age gap and the power imbalance and all of this stuff. They are two adults who have spent weeks communicating with one another over the app. You know, yes, it was a surprise to see exactly who was on the other end once they met in person, but I am enjoying seeing where this goes. I like what they're doing. It warmed my heart towards the end when, you know, Sam pulls Rebecca into the closet, and it's not to sneak a passionate kiss or anything like that. He just wants to hug her.
Yeah.
He just wants to be able to give her the hug he's wanted to give her all day. And, you know, as she said, he's wonderful.
Yeah.
The writer's room is very much aware that there is a power imbalance here. In an interview, Hannah Waddingham said that when she and Toheeb got the scripts, and they were like, "Oh my God, are we going here?" That she had some direct conversations with Jason Sudeikis about, "Okay, have you thought about this? I have a concern." This sort of thing. Unlike Shannon, I am still a little wary of the power situation here. Not so much the age difference, but
it is an issue.
Some potential things that could happen in the storyline that unrelated to this relationship that are coming up. The team has stayed remarkably together even after relegation. But at some point along the way, ownership, coaching, whatever, if the team is going to get promoted, if the team is going to succeed in the future, sometimes you have to get rid of players, even good players or even popular players, just to make changes. You know, at some point, what happens if Sam needs to go for the good of the team? You know, these sorts of things that are going to have to be dealt with potentially down the road. This show strains credibility in some ways just in the name of having a good workplace comedy story. But, you know, even at the end of season one, you know, Isaac was saying, you know, teams that get relegated get broken up. Hasn't happened yet, but it might. So yeah. All of this stuff does need to factor into the question of, Is this a healthy relationship? The writers have done everything possible to say to give us consent, enthusiastic consent between both people. The fact that banter is completely anonymous up until the moment of reveal, they got to know each other to a certain extent. Sam pursued Rebecca very clearly once he knew. Everybody at every level said, it's okay, I want this. But you can't just ignore that the fact that Rebecca has power over Sam is a thing that is going to have to be dealt with honestly in the end.
And I think it will be. That was my point, is let the writers finish telling the story. Instead of jumping down their throats, because yes, I mean, they recognize this. I mean, that's obviously a reason that Rebecca's been wanting to keep their relationship a secret, because, you know, she's fully aware, I think, of some of these implications. I'm tired of seeing people just react on the surface to the idea that this is a bad thing.
And that it could never be an okay thing. That's immediately, oh, yeah, this is just not ever going to be allowed. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that it's a woman in charge, and there's a layer of societal expectations that, oh, clearly this is going to be an issue. And I really appreciate how the writers are handling it. And I think if anyone could handle this type of a relationship, it's Rebecca and Sam. Sam clearly is extremely self-aware and knows his own value, as well as not his place. That's the wrong way to frame it, but like what his role is on the team and his role in the relationship and his role in each of these. And I think that it could end up being something really, really beautiful, especially like transitioning Sam from being a player and doing some sort of supportive role. I mean, we get rid of Nate, so here, let's not necessarily throw Sam onto the coaching team, but like there's other things that, or Sam turns into like environmental, like
Captain Planet.
yes. Oh yeah. Absolutely. And I think it'll be really interesting to see what they do with it.
Here's a bit of speculation. I don't know how contracts work in British football leagues. I know that the Jamie Tartt loan situation really doesn't work that way in the real world. What if Nate What if Rupert buys another team and poaches Nate to become manager of that team? What if they somehow go after Sam? Because Rupert had strong feelings about Sam. You know, Sam should be on defense where he belongs. You know, all this other stuff. You know, what if Sam is offered something that Sam cannot refuse? What decisions do Sam make? Plurals are tough. And how does Rebecca respond to that? This show is all about accountability. So adding that additional layer of relationship drama there, you know, I think that that's something that could happen.
I see your hypothetical, and I will raise you. I had a thought about what, you know, where are they going to go with a third season on this? How are they going to change the dynamic? How are they going to up the ante? Is, you know, we're naturally, we're waiting for them to pull themselves back to promotion, right? That's what we all really want for the team, right? Richmond until we die.
Right.
But what if the fact that Rebecca is taking this decision to seek self and find out a little bit more about her identity within her personal circles, within her isolation, how she does on her own, absolutely alone, and doesn't have to go seek things to fill that time or fill that attention.
Right.
And then she may weigh that against her role as the owner, now almost exclusive owner of this team. My brain went somewhere really, really far with this in the wee hours overnight last night. And I thought, with Higgins demonstrating so much of his absolute dyed-in-the-wool love for this team and the people that make it up and everything, what if Rebecca comes to a decision at some point that she's going to shift her career focus, sells or gives or something, gives the team to Higgins in its majority so that it allows her to eliminate that power imbalance and can remain with Sam without worrying about, you know, clicking tongues and tut-tuts?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, she's not just the boss. She's the owner.
Right.
So you're talking about giving away millions of pounds worth of stuff to Higgins. So that might be a little bit too far. But just because, you know, you can't give up being the owner. But maybe there are some decisions, decision-making structures that she could put in or something like that.
Help. Make it to where she's the owner and she owns the team, but isn't in the decision-making process. So it takes away that power dynamic because, yes, she's the owner, but she doesn't have any, like, managing control. I don't know if she'd... she would have to find something else to bring that joy into her life. I think she's really loving this part of her life now that it's not just getting back at her ex and being able to own herself and her power and her strength in what she does. It would be really, it would have to be replaced with something different, that's bigger, which I don't know.
And I think we're getting to the point where that's going to be hard to find because, you know, even at the end of last season, you know, and she's watching, you know, she's talked to Ted. She told Ted what she had been trying to do. He forgave her. And, you know, she was starting to get invested, invested in the team. And this season, you know, I've been adoring the, you know, even though, as you know, we said, it's kind of unrealistic that so many of the core players of the team are still there after relegation. But the team aspect among the players, the Christmas episode where they all go to the Higginses, everybody surrounding Sam for his haircut.
Everybody and now, showing up to the funeral.
And dressed, and as Isaac said, you're wearing suits, you're wearing ties, Jamie, you're wearing a shirt, and we're all wearing dress shoes.
Yes.
And you could see how touched Rebecca was by that when the bus pulled up and they all started coming out and she's just like,
how many are here?
How many of them? You know, would this happen on a normal team? Would this have happened? Would the team have come together for their owner like this? And I'm not sure they would have.
Yeah, clearly not. There was no indication before this. And I think I loved the progression that Isaac has had as the leader.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see the support that everyone has for him, not just because he can do an amazing haircut and not just because he's whatever, quote unquote, best player, whatever. He owns their support and he has earned it. And they return that respect and that support to him, which in just a magical way.
Since we did mention the dress shoes versus trainers discussion, yes. I just want to take a moment and just express how much it hurt my heart at an unbelievably profound level to see Danny in pain and see him upset about something, see him angry about something.
So this is one of the things that I would have edited differently. One of like two choices that were made in the show. I think it was too much. I enjoyed the interplay and how, you know, he ended up stealing the fluffy slippers. But are they like, what size are these shoes? Are they too small? Like, yes, I get that, you know, new shoes are uncomfortable, but there was blood on his big toe and it was wrapped in a Band-Aid.
I don't know. I mean, I was too busy relating to that because, you know, it's like every time I see Rebecca walking around in heels, I'm just like, how can you? Because I cannot. I cannot wear heels anymore, ever. And, you know, so for me, it was more of relating of the fact that, you know, these are players who, you know, for the most part, spend every part of their lives in their cleats, you know, or their tennis shoes. So, you know, just even the structure and shape of a dress shoe, I could see that it would bother them. And for me, this was the bit of them pushing into the comedy a little more. The idea that, you know, that Danny just could not stand wearing dress shoes. He did it anyway until the last possible minute because Rebecca. But yeah, for me, I would thought it was funny because I found it relatable.
All right. Well, speaking of relatable, a panic attack. Yes. Before we hit the funeral, let's go to Ted. The intersection between his joyful exuberance, not singing along to the song to Easy Lover, but just mouthing the words as you get mm-hmm. ready. Like that's someone who's like so relaxed, because when you're like extra hyped or excited to be getting ready or whatever, you sing at the top of your lungs. But if you're just gonna lip sync about it, you're just chill. You're like, yeah, I've got the good music going on. And then the sound effects for the panic attack once again are just
mm-hmm.
perfection.
Yeah.
How did you all, this secondary, or I guess tertiary panic attack for Ted, and especially knowing that his dad died, not the details of it yet, but like how did you react when that started?
Has it started to
develop? So I have had panic attacks before, and I see a therapist every couple of weeks, dealing with anxiety, depression, and just, you know, various side effects of living in the world that we live in right now. I have been really impressed by how authentic Dr. Sharon Fieldstone's practice is in this show. And how she sets good boundaries for herself, and at least at a TV sitcom level, she does what she does with the ethics of the profession in mind. You know, I've seen some therapists sort of questioning some of her approach, but as far as TV is concerned, she feels like she very much resembles my therapist. She uses techniques that my therapist uses, and she handles the boundaries just so extraordinarily well. You know, jumping ahead to the end when Ted asks if it's okay for her to hug him, and she does, and she says, "You're going to charge me for this, right?" And she says, "Of course I am. It's a house call." and Ted's response, "I appreciate your integrity." You know, they are not friends. They are somewhat colleagues. They are somewhat client therapist relationship kind of thing. But She does everything right.
Yes.
And she draws out the things that Ted needs to think about. And we're seeing Ted on a healing process here throughout the season. And in this episode, yeah. you know, he doesn't hesitate to call her. And
yes. Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. And she doesn't hesitate to immediately go.
Right. Yeah, that was something that I love, that the fact that, you know, he realized and he immediately called her. They are to the point in their client-patient, whatever relationship, that he did not even hesitate, but he called her first. And I really liked that.
Yeah.
It almost feels as if they have a very well-bounded client-patient relationship, but mm-hmm. They have earned the right with one another when that clock is off to be able to ask for immediate interaction to turn that clock back on. And I don't know if I'm expressing this right. This is something where in the situation where he reaches out to her, and you knew when you saw him start to hesitate upon trying to affix his tie, and you heard the sound effects and you knew that this was setting in, we knew, okay, you're going to be able to reach out to Sharon. You have this relationship. You've earned this right. She knows you. You trust her. You knew he was going to go for the phone. Her answering it, absolutely expected. This is what you do when one of your patients reaches out to you. The fact that the immediacy with which she drops everything and says that I'm on my way is mm-hmm. something that I think that I feel like it says something a little bit more than just saying, you know, let's stay on the phone with me for a few more minutes. Let's talk this through.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just feel like that is something slightly above and beyond that says that maybe it's because of the professional respect they have for one another, or maybe there is an underlying friendship to this as well. However infantile it might be, you know, fledgling.
Or for some people, she's not going to do anything to undermine the fact that Ted reached out to her. I'm trying to figure out exactly how to express this, but you know, for like when I'm teaching, you know, there are some students that you know, in a big classroom of 30 plus kids, there are some kids that I can say, give me a minute because I'm, you know, working with another kid or something like that. There are kids that I know that can wait a minute because it's not all that serious. And then there are kids that, you know, if they get my attention, I need to respond immediately. Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of, you know, Sharon recognizes that, you know, we're at a point in Ted's healing process that, you know, she needs to, you know, go immediately, do everything right, and make sure he understands that he's got her support.
And the fact that she immediately was like, okay, you're safe, do your breathing, let me give you these tools to keep it together until I get there. And knowing immediately, like, clearly she's amazing at her job. And here's another proof for the viewer of how incredible she is at her job.
Yeah. And then the conversation itself. We'll get back to the funeral in a second, but that intercut between Ted talking about his dad and Rebecca talking about hers, my jaw was dropping, technically. That was just so beautiful. But the fact that to learn that, you know, it was kind of foreshadowed that Ted's dad had killed himself, and that clearly that had affected Ted. He was, mm-hmm. you know, 16 years old. To learn that he was the one that he, you know, almost witnessed it, that he discovered, yeah. that heard the shot, discovered the, you know, came up and was the one to find the body. Just that had my heart aching
so deeply. And the fact that the main story is intercut, and both of them, you know, having these emotional raw experiences, but then the story that Ted tells about the good thing about his father mm-hmm. was all him.
Yeah.
was so poignant and so purposeful. Once again, the care for this, because you know, like, I can imagine the writers were like, okay, we need to get both of these stories out. How can we make it so that it's not so overwhelming? Because either one of those stories all by itself would have just been too much, and it would have been, it felt so heavy and defeating almost. And so by combining them together, it allows you to almost stay, in my mind, I was present in the story without having to dwell too deeply on how dark and horrifying both of the stories are, because I can't even imagine either one of those.
I appreciate you saying that, because until hearing that take on it, I was actually a little concerned about the nature of the editing between the two scenes. I felt like I was being robbed a little bit of some of the impact of one or the other. But I guess you kind of have to temper that and look at that as the fact that, well, could you, would you even really want to linger on either one of these stories for too long and risk, as a viewer, pulling them down to a level where it'd be very, very difficult to lift it back up to, hey, this is a comedy show, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
So I understand that. I appreciate you both saying that.
Yeah, because the first time I watched it, I felt the same way that you did. I was like, why would they do this? And then seeing the second time watching and recognizing, oh, not only, like, this was on purpose so that you weren't, so that you were emotionally ready for the future sad parts in the funeral that were to come, that were still going to let your heart lift a little bit. It pulled you out of that deep darkness that could have been too heavy. And so I really appreciate that. Oh, all right. Well, I think that means the main story is here. you know, an hour later, the funeral is the whole, you know, it's the titular poignant moment of the show, and it takes up so much of the time and energy, and I love how it was woven throughout the entire story. Again, it was so purposeful. There was so many good choices in this to let you feel what was going on. I wonder, so I'm just thinking specifically of, like, Coach Beard's moment in the church where he's on the phone. Was that filmed later after they wrote the Coach Beard goes out part? Because yes, he's holding the phone up for the main part of the funeral, but there was nobody else in the scene. Like, did they decide, oh, let me slip this in to keep the continuity? Because we know that that was one of the second filler episodes. Like, again, everything is purposeful. The entire funeral, tell me your thoughts.
Something that occurred to me this morning as I was thinking about it, just the actual funeral itself, the scene with everybody seated there, and then Rebecca, you know, doesn't know what to say. She's trying to figure out what to say. And then the way she starts singing, and, you know, gradually Ted supports her and, you know, sings back. And then she's looking at her mom, and it made me think of the honest to goodness fact, funerals, you know, we talk about honoring the person who's passed and, you know, and their memory and all that, as if a funeral is for that person. And well, that person's dead. Funerals are for the people who are left behind to process and grieve, and ideally have support from friends, family, and community.
And strangers that you don't know who they are.
Yeah. But the fact that entire sequence eventually centered back around Rebecca and her mother reconnecting. I mean, we've never seen Rebecca's dad. I'm not even sure we know Rebecca's dad's name.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's his funeral, quote unquote. And instead, it's about, you know, it's about helping Rebecca and her mom reconnect. you know, the team and the, everyone giving her support physically in the church. Once Ted starts singing, then they all start doing it. And it turns into a moment about, you know, the living and not the dead. And I just found that, like, really interesting and really touching.
I agree 110%. This is the one scene, though, that I wish that there had been some changes. I wish it had been cut a little bit more. It seemed to go on a little bit long, lingering on the rest of the audience. Mm-hmm. But again, it's so minor. Like, it's, I had it desperately, like, what would I change? And like, that's it.
I think that little, that moment could have had the same, just knowing that the congregation starts to sing along and maybe getting through a bar or two of it, and then you can quickly take it to the, you know, out in the front steps again, would still have the same impact. Because the longer I listen to it, the longer I think, this is a horribly inappropriate song for a
well, yeah, that's the, yeah, and that's half the point. But they all join in. And I feel like it had to go on for that long because they sort of like did a check-in with so many of the different, you know, you get to see Sam, you see, you know, Danny and Jamie. As the lady behind Danny, you know, sympathizes with him in his shoes. You see Roy and Keeley. You know, you see Ted. You know, so like they were jumping back and forth between Rebecca and so many people in the audience. I think that's one reason it went on a bit. But
yeah,
because that's what this show does. It checks in on all the characters.
Yeah,
it really does.
Yeah. But what a beautiful funeral, beautiful church. I loved the, you know, the priest who has, again, built these minor characters that it would have been so easy to not meet him at all, but you see his frustration with the laughter and loudness in one of the off rooms, the library or whatever you want to call it, and being able to build his character, and then he's going to come up and say, oh, you know, I knew him so well. He was sitting in the corner, having his moment, listening, hanging on every word of the game. Like, that, again, personal side of it, of everything, and having him really recognize, I'm not here, like, this isn't for me. I'm here because I have to, and yes, I appreciate, you know, but we're going to have Rebecca, I guess, surprise eulogy. I'm sure mom signed her up for it and didn't tell her. And just like, okay, let's have this. We didn't have to do a lot of serious church things to know that it's a funeral in a church. And I appreciated that.
All in all, I walk away from this particular episode with a lot more concerns about the well-being of the characters than I often do. A lot of times I get to sit back and sort of bask in the glow of, wasn't that, that was great. Didn't we do some hilarious things, or didn't we learn some wonderful things, or aren't these two or three or this bunch of people, aren't they wonderful together? This is one where everybody has, they came into it or over the course of this story have been sort of, like I said, opened up kind of raw. You know, that we're seeing them at some of their peak vulnerability. And then not a lot of that gets resolved. It's just a matter of the fact that everybody sort of, you know, puts their elbows down on the edge of the table and says, okay, I or we all have work to do. And that's kind of the feeling that it left me with, saying, okay, with two episodes left in the season, we've got work to do. Well, damn right we've got work to do. I need to feel good at the end of this thing, and you've got two episodes to get it done. But I think that's one of the things that makes this show so fascinating, is because it does not follow any sort of what I would consider to be a traditional sort of arc of empathy versus conflict versus resolution over the course of a given season, or even over the series as a whole. It goes where it needs to. It's sort of the waters around the stones, and I'm just fascinated by the decisions that the writer's room makes. As you said earlier, we've put a lot of trust in them. to do right by these characters that they've created for us and that they've forced us to love as they have. but that trust is definitely there. And in return, I have faith that the writers are going to do something that is genuine and respectful to the relationships and the situations that they've set in motion. But all the same, it doesn't eliminate the fact that I'm just really damn concerned for all these people and their well-being.
We are invested.
Yeah. We are invested. Yeah. I asked in a previous episode of the podcast whether this was turning into a dramedy. And, you know, I'm feeling a certain amount of soap opera-ness to the show at this point. It is still hugely funny. I mean, at the most maudlin or sad moments of the story, then you've got Danny Rojas having shoe issues. And the slippers are adorable.
Or Flo eviscerating Rupert.
Yes. Yes. we have all of those moments. So I think soap opera and dramedy are both inappropriate words, but we are watching character arcs developing all over the place here. We are invested in the character outcomes. Hopefully we're not judging the characters so much as we're just watching and enjoying and learning from the stuff that they're going through as they go. And in the end, all of our characters are there in that funeral, in that church, to support Rebecca. Mm-hmm. And there's just a remarkable unity there. If you ignore Rupert, there's just remarkable unity there. There've been some criticisms of this season in that there's no genuine antagonist at this point. I think that's coming. But the character conflicts have been internal, and they've been, mm-hmm. They've been not so much between opponents, but mm-hmm. as just people just sort of working out how to exist with each other. Most obviously,
with themselves.
Yeah,
with themselves mm-hmm. too.
Most obviously, right. Between Ted and Sharon, as Ted comes to terms with, you know, I've got to. If I'm not doing my helping people thing, if I'm not having the impact with my players and with the people around me, then what good am I? And now with this episode, we find out exactly why that is. The thing that drives Ted Lasso, the character, is to fix other people around him because mm-hmm. he didn't fix his father. Mm-hmm. And when Ted is telling Sharon that his father was a great talker, imagine that, could have been a better listener, he is talking mm-hmm. about himself. And I suspect that he is having those moments of self-realization along the way right now. And we are privileged to be able to watch it happen over the course of this series.
Yes. And I hope this helps more than just the characters. These really honest and true moments on a show can help viewers that maybe need a little support from someone who they can trust. You know, this parasocial relationship with these characters in the show that clearly, obviously, they're actors performing them, but, you know, brains are weird. And this moment, this episode is just so great because next week is the penultimate episode and then we have the season finale. And so you can feel the pressure of building, and yet there's still so much good in this episode that just makes it, there's a reason this show is my favorite show.
Joy among the tears.
Yes, exactly. And with that, I shall wipe my tears and say goodbye. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. And thank you so much, Shannon, Chip, and Keir, for being with me and being my supportive team, showing up without trainers on this episode of Football is Life.
We promise we'll never give you up.
Thank you, everyone. Your generosity knows no bounds.
Always a pleasure.
We'll see you next week with a different cast of characters.